Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241. It's October 20th. And we're going to finish up visual system today. And so it doesn't look like we're going to have three lectures on endocrinology before the 29th. So it looks like we're going to have the next test on November 3rd. That's a bummer. Okay, so that's going to be a Tuesday, November 3rd on Tuesday. And I probably won't change my mind on that. It's actually, I don't want to postpone it a whole week. That would be really, really hard to do. Thursday's better? Yeah, I think we're going to do it on Tuesday. We'll do it on Tuesday. Yeah, way in the back. It's going to be 9, 10, and 11. 9, 10, and 11. Okay, so if that's a difficult day for you, you just have to prepare a little bit more in advance. That's all there's to it. Okay? So that's the way it goes. All right, so I think we were talking about this slide already. Let me turn some lights down. No, you're not. You're good. All right, so we were talking about how light focuses on the retina. The retina is the photoreceptor part of the eye. And from anatomy, you should know where the retina is. As a matter of fact, you should review your anatomy of the eye. Probably you did that in lab. The three layers of the eye would be from deep to superficial, the retina, the choroid, and the sclera. Photoreceptors are in the retina. And in order to see something sharp, the curvatures, there are a couple curvatures of the eye that have to work together to focus light on the retina. And that's the cornea and the lens. The cornea is fixed. All right, it has a high degree of focusing power. The lens can adjust itself, and it doesn't have as great a focusing power as the cornea, but it does allow you to do something. What does the lens allow you to do? Okay, yeah, accommodation. So accommodation is the key word, and of course you should know what that means at this point in time. But if for whatever reason you can't focus clearly, right, for instance, oh, I remember talking about this now, right, if the eyeball is too short, then light rays focus behind the eye. You then need a convex lens in front of the eye to start to converge the light rays before they enter the eye, and so now it focuses at the right spot. On the other hand, if the eyeball is too long, then light focuses before it gets to the retina, and then it starts to diverge again by the time it reaches the retina. And to fix this particular problem, which we call myopia, then you need a concave lens to spread the light out a little bit before it enters the eye. And if you have an astigmatism, it just means that the lens or the cornea somehow is asymmetrical, and some objects might be in focus, maybe at the top of your visual field, but then the objects in your lower part of your visual field won't be in focus. Or it could be a right and left, or it could be any combination anywhere around the clock. So then you need an aspherical lens to correct for that abnormality. Okay. All right, so let's move to the retina. So the retina contains the photoreceptor cells. And generally speaking, you have two kinds of photoreceptor cells. You got rods and cones. And rods are quite a bit bigger than cones, although we don't necessarily see that on this particular diagram right here. The cones are smaller. They're a lot thinner than the rods. And you can see the extent of the retina. So this is going to be vitreous humor out over here. Notice that light has to pass by ganglion cells, amacrine cells, bipolar cells, right, even horizontal cells before they get to the photoreceptor cells. The photoreceptor cells are deep within the retina. All right, rod cells are important for black and white vision, but they're highly sensitive so that you can see in dim light with the rod cells, but in dim light you have no perception of color. Cone cells, on the other hand, you can see fine detail with them. You can see in color, The trade-off is what kind of light you need in order for the cones to work. You need bright light, right? So cones are black and white, not such high resolution. They give you kind of blurry images, but they work very well in dim light. Cones, on the other hand, require bright light. They give you high resolution pictures in color. All right. So when we look at the retina right here, it is the rods and cones that absorb light, right, and then stimulate the bipolar cells, which then stimulate the ganglion cells, and the ganglion cells have axons that project into the brain for your conscious appreciation of light. The horizontal cells and the amacrine cells right here, we don't talk much about the function of these particular cells in the visual system, but they process information before action potentials even get to the brain. So they adjust your vision before it even gets into the central nervous system. So these are signal processing cells. And suffice it to say, enough about that. Okay. All right, so this is a better representation of the relative size of the cone cells and the rod cells. All right, they have an outer segment and an inner segment. Here is the inner segment that is what kind of projecting into the vitreous humor, deeper into the eye. And an outer segment that is composed of stacks of photopigment discs. All right, and these are the discs right here that can interact with photons or light rays. The new discs are added at the base, and then they migrate their way up to the apex of the cell, and then they're sloughed off, and then that layer is removed by the pigment epithelium of the retina to recycle the materials. Right, so the rods and cones are kind of remodeling themselves all the time, although the cells don't die themselves. Right, but they're highly metabolic cells. They require a lot of glucose to stay active. All right, the other thing that the pigment epithelium does on this choroid layer right here is that it absorbs excessive light so that when light enters your eye, it doesn't bounce around, so you don't see flashes of light in your visual field. It also delivers nutrients to the photoreceptors. Notice that in the retina right here, you see any blood vessels. And indeed not. There should not be any blood vessels in the retina, because if there were, what would happen to these rods and cones? They get pushed aside, because you can't have two cells in the same place. I know I try to do that all the time, and I know you students try to do that all the time, be in two places at one time, but you just can't make that happen. Right? So if there are blood vessels that develop in the retina, that produces a retinopathy, or it destroys your vision. Right? It creates a blindness. All right, so this choroid level layer down here has blood vessels which nourish all of these cells right here. And that layer also protects the retina from an autoimmune disease, from being attacked by a person's own immune system. And it also stabilizes all of the various ion levels. It almost acts like, didn't talk about this, maybe in anatomy you did, right, cerebral spinal fluid, but this layer adjusts various concentrations of ions in this layer right here, like sodium, potassium, calcium, right? And of course you all know how important those are for adjusting the electrical properties of a cell, right, for causing depolarization or hyperpolarization or whatever. All right, so how does the eyes work? And we're going to talk primarily about the rod cells. There is something that absorbs light in the rod cells. So generally speaking, what do we call something that absorbs light? Like melanin is a biological compound that absorbs light. Chlorophyll is a biological compound that absorbs light. So anything that absorbs light basically is a pigment. All right. So when we look around the room, the seats kind of look yellow to me. All right, so when white light, which has all the wavelengths of color, all the colors of the rainbow, when white light hits a chair, the reason why it looks yellow is because it absorbs everything, all the wavelengths in light, all the energies of light, except yellow. It's reflected back to you, and it's picked up by your eye. All right, so if you see something that looks blue, like maybe this binder right here, what's happening? There's a pigment in that binder, the cover of the binder, that is doing what? It's absorbing the spectrum of light except for the blue color, and it reflects the blue color, and that bounces into your eye, stimulating your retina. All right, so here is a pigment in your eye called rhodopsin. And rhodopsin absorbs many different kinds of wavelengths. So it is not sensitive to color, it's just sensitive to light. And so this is what we have in rod cells, which are what kind of receptors? Color receptors or black and white? Black and white. So you can't tell color with this particular kind of receptor. If you want to think of it like an antenna that you might have on your car, you know, that's probably not a bad analogy. All right, so rhodopsin has two different kinds of chemicals that come together. There is retinol, which we see right here, and then opsin. All right, so if we put retinol and opsin together, we get something called rhodopsin. And notice how nicely they fit together. Right, if the retinol is in a cis conformation, if it's in a cis conformation, it has this little bend or hook in it, right? And so now it has the correct shape to bind to opsin. So here is a nice chemical formula for cis retinol. But when light hits this compound right here, it causes a change in conformation of the retinol. So this side chain straightens out. We call that a trans conformation. And when it straightens out, it no longer fits in the binding site, and it dissociates from the opsin molecule. That process is what we call bleaching. All right, so light is energy. It can cause a change in conformation. It's a very slight conformation change, but remember, when you change the shape of something, what are you changing? Yeah, you're changing the function of it, right? So now it can't fit into the active site. And when this happens, that changes the permeability of ions in the membrane of the rod cells, which then causes action potentials to develop in the ganglion cells. And of course, the axons of ganglion cells go all the way into the brain and you perceive color. Okay. So the ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials. Rods, cones, bipolars, and horizontal cells produce graded potential changes. All right, so rods and cones have generator potentials that develop when they absorb light. Visual transduction, now what do we mean by visual transduction? What does transduction mean? Changing from one energy modality into another energy modality. So what are we interested in being sensitive to? What is the eye sensitive to? Light energy, all right, there's certainly energy in light. And the eye changes light energy into another form of energy, which is what? What's the language that your brain works with? Action potentials, right? So going from light energy to action potentials, that's what we call visual transduction. And visual transduction is the inverse of other sensory systems. So normally, how would you cause stimulation of a cell? How would you cause stimulation? Like if you have a touch receptor and you activate a touch receptor, what would be one way to, or maybe even a hair cell? Okay, how do you excite a cell typically? Okay, and you should think in terms of ion channels. How do you excite a cell in terms of ion channels? Yeah, depolarization. Depolarization is opening up typically a sodium channel, all right, and then that might start an action potential going to the brain. All right, but for the visual system, it's really the opposite kind of scheme. All right, in dark, the photoreceptors release an inhibitory neurotransmitter, and that hyperpolarizes the bipolar cells. And light, when light shines on the retina, that actually inhibits the photoreceptor cells from releasing that inhibitory neurotransmitter. And if you inhibit an inhibitory system, that's what? That's a double negative. That's really exciting the system. All right, so I got a couple slides to talk about this. All right, so rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. So in the dark, was that In the absence of stimulus or in the presence of stimulus? In the absence of stimulus. Look what's happening. The sodium channels are open. So what's happening to the rods and cone cells in the absence of stimulus? They are depolarizing, which is what we usually consider what? An excitatory event, right? We usually call that EPSP. Right? And that depolarizing influx of sodium is what we call a dark current. So the rods and cones, I'm actually just talking about the rods right now, in the absence of stimulus, they are depolarizing because that sodium is entering the cells. Light, on the other hand, when light reaches the retina, that hyperpolarizes the rod cells by closing the sodium channels. All right, so that's what I mean about this being an inverse system. All right, so here are a couple diagrams that clearly show what's going on here. So here we have a rod cell. Here we have a rhodopsin molecule, and bound to it is the cisretinol, right? So it has a little bend in it, so it's going to bind to the opsin. And also on this disc, here is a G protein. We don't have a receptor for this G protein, not like you think in terms of other kinds of transduction systems. The receptor is really the rhodopsin molecule. So it's not waiting for a chemical signal, it's waiting for a beam of light, right? A photon, some light. Okay, so here you have the G protein. It's not activated because all these subunits are bound together and they're sitting on the membrane of this disc. And here we have a sodium channel. And what can you tell me about this sodium channel right here? It's open. So sodium enters the cell. That is doing what to this cell? It's depolarizing it. This sodium channel will remain open as long as we have a cyclic GMP molecule bound to the receptor. Right? So this is what's going to control the gate on this sodium channel right here. So this is the plasma membrane. Here is an enzyme called phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase's job is to break down cyclic GMP into regular old GMP. And when it gets broken, when cyclic GMP breaks down to GMP, it no longer has the right shape. It can't bind to this channel right here. All right, so in the dark, this phosphodiesterase is in an inactive form. So cyclic GMP levels are high when the rod cells are in the dark, in the absence of stimulus. And in the absence of stimulus, then cyclic GMP is high, sodium is entering the cell, depolarizing it, so that's what we call the dark current, when sodium enters a cell in the dark. All right, so what's going to happen when there's stimulus, when there's a light ray? So light comes in, the cisretinol can't absorb it, right? That's like doing what? Poking you in the side. When it absorbs that energy, it's going to change conformation, right? And when it changes conformation, which is what we call a bleaching reaction, it's going to activate the G protein right here. The alpha subunit then wanders around in the rod cell, bumps into a phosphodiesterase, and it becomes activated, right? So when it binds to the alpha subunit of the G protein, phosphodiesterase goes from inactive to active. And the job of phosphodiesterase is to convert cyclic GMP into regular old GMP. It disrupts the ring structure, so now it can no longer bind to the sodium channel, and the sodium channel changes conformation. It closes. So what happens to the current of sodium entering the cell? It stops. So what happens to the electrical property of the cell when we stop this sodium current? It hyperpolarizes, right? It becomes inhibited. So these rod cells are stimulated in the dark, but they are inhibited when stimulus is present, right? Which is kind of a different theme that we're used to observing. All right, well, how does this affect visual transduction? Okay, let's look at these two cases again, in the dark and in the light. So here we have a nice rod cell. Here we have some bipolar cells, and then here we have a ganglion cell. So we've left out the horizontal cells and the amacrine cells, which are just important for signal processing. right? And don't forget, this ganglion cell then sends axons to the brain, all right? Eventually going to your occipital lobe in the brain so that you have the perception of color. All right, so here we have the rod cell. We got the outer segment and inner segment right here. And in the dark, what can you tell me about the levels of cyclic GMP? In the dark, cyclic GMP is high because phosphodiesterase is inactive. All right, so there's high levels of cyclic GMP in the dark. Cyclic GMP binds to this sodium channel, keeping it open. So sodium enters a cell, causing it to depolarize, right? So it's depolarizing. That means that it's going to be releasing neurotransmitter in the dark. So this rod cell is releasing neurotransmitter, but this neurotransmitter is an inhibitory neurotransmitter on the bipolar cell. So in the dark, even though the rod cell is depolarizing, what about this bipolar cell? It is hyperpolarizing because this neurotransmitter from the rod cell is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So how would you explain how this neurotransmitter can produce hyperpolarization in this bipolar cell? Maybe it's opening a chloride channel. Maybe it's opening a potassium channel, right? There's various kinds of ways you could think about that. But it's going to inhibit this bipolar cell. So when the bipolar cell is inhibited, what kind of neurotransmitter is it going to be releasing? None, right? It's not releasing neurotransmitter. Hence, this ganglion cell, right, is not being stimulated as a result. It's not sending action potentials to the brain, even though the rod cell is depolarizing because of the dark current. All right, so that's pretty strange. You're going to have to look at this figure. This is a really good exam figure, right? So if you can figure this out, that's really nice. And of course, you have the typical sodium-potassium ATP pump that is restoring, right, the proper ion levels inside the cell. So now let's look in the condition when light is turned on. And why do action potentials reach the brain when light is turned on? All right, well, that rhodopsin is bleached, the G protein is activated, and when that's activated, what happens? Let's see if I can go back really quick. This phosphodiesterase gets converted from an inactive form to an active form, and that degrades cyclic GMP into regular old GMP, and so it can't bind to the sodium channel. Right, so that closes that sodium channel. So what does that do to the rod cell? That hyperpolarizes, which is what? Inhibits the rod cell. So when the rod cell is inhibited, what about the neurotransmitter that it's releasing? It stops. But don't forget, that neurotransmitter is inhibitory on the bipolar cell. So when the bipolar cell is no longer inhibited, guess what it does? It releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, and that then produces action potentials that go to your visual cortex. All right, so this is a different scheme than what you're used to, but just rely on your knowledge of the actions of various ion channels, right? Excitatory would be sodium, inhibitory would be potassium or chloride channels, for instance. All right, so that's how this whole system works. All right, who's got a question about that? You might actually have to look at this figure a couple times before you're comfortable with it. All right, but just remember that the neurotransmitter from the rod cell is what? Inhibitory. The neurotransmitter from the bipolar cell is excitatory, and it's just in the dark, this inhibitory neurotransmitter inhibits the bipolar cell so that no action potentials reach the brain, and that's due to the fact that this rod cell is depolarizing in the dark, right? And it is hyperpolarizing when there's light. Okay, so don't forget about this mechanism with the G protein and the phosphodiesterase. That's important to know. Okay, so that's it for visual system. Oh, that's faster than I thought. Maybe we should have the test done. maybe not. Okay. So I tell you what. I better write this down on the board for people that maybe came in late. Test 3, which are chapters 9, 10, and 11, instead of the 29th, November 3rd. Okay, so pass it around. All right, so now let's move on to the endocrine chapter. Okay, what's that? Oh, good. It came back. Whatever it was, it went away. Okay, an endocrine gland. We got to talk about what an endocrine gland is. It has some structural features that make it different from other kinds of glands, like exocrine glands. Who can tell me what an exocrine gland is? It has a duct, right? So an exocrine gland produces some kind of product that's going to have some effect on your body, but an exocrine gland secretes that product into a duct, and the duct carries it to where it goes in the body to perform its function. So a good example of an exocrine gland would be the pancreas. Okay, would be the pancreas when it's secreting digestive enzymes. Where do those digestive enzymes belong? Do they belong in the pancreas? Should they work in the pancreas? No, they should work in your digestive tract, right? So they hop a ride in a duct that takes them to the digestive tract so that the pancreas doesn't get digested or other organs along the way. Okay. An endocrine gland, on the other hand, doesn't need a duct because there's another system for delivering its product all over the body, and that is the circulatory system, right? So there are capillaries and endocrine glands that absorb the signaling molecules, and then those signaling molecules are carried everywhere in the body. And those signaling molecules we call a hormone. That's a general class of name, a hormone. So a hormone, right, has to be secreted by an endocrine gland, which is a ductless gland. And then it gets picked up by the blood. The blood is the delivery system, right? And it's going to travel to a distant site to affect the metabolism of a distant tissue. So how can a hormone affect a distant tissue? What does that distant tissue have to have in order to sense that there's a hormone that's trying to communicate with it? There's got to be a receptor, right? So if there is a receptor for a particular hormone in a tissue, then we call that tissue a target tissue. So let's look at some endocrine glands. All right, so the hypothalamus right here releases hormones that travel to the pituitary. So the hypothalamus is part of the brain, but it's also an endocrine gland. The pituitary has a couple parts to it, which we're going to look at. It secretes other hormones, so it is an endocrine gland because those hormones travel by the blood everywhere in the body. And in particular, the pituitary gland controls the thyroid gland. So the thyroid gland is controlled by the pituitary, and the thyroid gland secretes other hormones that controls metabolism throughout the body. Hormones from the pituitary also control the adrenal gland and the gonads, like the ovary and testes. These are reproductive organs. All right, let's see, what other kinds of endocrine glands do we see here? I mentioned the pancreas in terms of synthesizing and secreting digestive enzymes, but here we see it in the slide for endocrine gland. What does that mean? It has both functions. It has both exocrine function and endocrine function. And what the pancreas does, that's where the hormone insulin comes from. Probably heard of that one. And another hormone called glucagon that work in opposition to each other. They're antagonistic to each other. Okay. So don't forget, a target tissue has to have a receptor. Some hormones that travel by the blood are secreted by neurons, and in that particular case, sometimes it might be confusing, is that really a hormone or is it a neurotransmitter? Because a neurotransmitter classically is something that is released from a neuron. But if it is delivered by the circulatory system all over the body, then we call that a neurohormone, right? So the hypothalamus secretes neurohormones, right? And hormones then change metabolism inside the cells. So here we have a number of different organs, right? Like the adrenal cortex secretes glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids like aldosterone, and it tells us what the primary target organ is. So what do these target organs have to have? They got to have a receptor, right? How would you explain the binding of aldosterone to a kidney? How does aldosterone know when to bind to a receptor that the kidney might have? How do you describe that? It's got to be lock and key, hand and glove, right? The shape of the hormone has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor. If the shape doesn't match up, then there's no binding, right? So just like what? Acetylcholine on a nicotinic receptor. If you change the shape of nicotine, it won't bind to the receptor. Okay, so we're going to talk about a number of these for the next 3 days. So I don't want to just read a number of them to you, but you probably want to refer to this table as we go along every once in a while. All right, so chemical hormones can be classified depending on what kind of chemical compound they are. We have amine hormones. What can you tell me about an amino group? What has it got in there? Nitrogen, right? Like an NH2 kind of group. They're derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. Tyrosine and tryptophan are amino acids that have a nice amino group on them. And these include norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine from the thyroid gland, and melatonin. There are other kinds of hormones, which are polypeptide or protein hormones. And they're just made up of chains of amino acids. Could be a short number, maybe 5 or 6 to much longer chains of amino acids. And these include antidiuretic hormone. So I'm going to be using the acronyms and interchangeably with the names of these hormones. This ADH regulates fluid balance and electrolyte balance in our body. And maybe you could figure that out, because what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. An antidiuretic makes you retain water, right? So growth hormone makes you grow. Insulin regulates blood glucose levels with glucagon working antagonistically, right? Oxytocin stimulates smooth muscle into contraction. And ACTH stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. Adrenal corticotropic. So this ACTH stimulates the adrenal gland, and in particular, the cortex. What part of the adrenal gland is the cortex? It's the, yeah, this is true, but in proper anatomic language, we would say the superficial part, right? So if you say outside, that's right, everybody would know what you're talking about. But if you say superficial, that would even be better. Okay. Parathyroid hormone. All right. Some other hormones are glycoproteins, which are modifications of a protein to include a sugar molecule. All right. So sugar proteins, these would include luteinizing hormone, important for regulating reproductive health of both males and females, follicle-stimulating hormone, and thyroid-stimulating hormone. And then some are steroids. And so steroids, remember, are lipids. And steroids are all derived from cholesterol, right? So you probably heard a lot of bad things about cholesterol because it can cause arterial sclerosis. But cholesterol is, of course, very important because it forms the basis molecule for steroid hormones like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol that's secreted by the adrenal cortex, and nobody probably would want to give up any of these hormones. All right, so you got to have proper levels of cholesterol in your body. So you might recognize that some of these chemical compounds are lipids, which means that they are hydrophobic, and some, like these amines and glycoproteins here, are hydrophilic. Right, there are hydrophobic and hydrophilic kinds, which means In terms of the plasma membrane, I guess maybe I'll just ask you, what does that mean in terms of the plasma membrane? Some can diffuse through the plasma membrane and others cannot, right? So steroid hormones can, and all lipid hormones can diffuse through the cell membrane, but the rest of these hormones can't get inside the cell. So for all these hormones that can't get inside the cell, where does the receptor have to be? It's got to be on the outside of the cell, on the plasma membrane. But steroid hormones, where is the receptor? It's inside, right? It's in the cytoplasm, or it could even be a nuclear receptor inside the nucleus. All right, well, this is a blast from the past. You can see what cholesterol right here. And basically what I want to show you is that cholesterol can be modified in different ways to make progesterone, and then progesterone can be further modified to make cortisol. Right, progesterone then can be modified to make androstenedione, and then that can be converted into testosterone. And so all of these compounds are related to each other. And then look at estrogen right here. Estrogen is actually made from testosterone. Okay, in these different organs, like the adrenal cortex, the ovary, and testes right here. So all of these compounds are related. They have different actions because they all have a little bit different shape associated with them. Okay, just modifications of the side chains. There's another lipid type of hormone, and that is thyroxine. That comes from the thyroid gland. Right? And of course, since it's a lipid kind of molecule, it has to have a cytoplasmic receptor, not a membrane receptor. So it can diffuse into target cells. There are two major kinds of thyroid hormones. The other interesting thing that we notice on this diagram is that in order to be an active hormone, it has to incorporate kind of a strange atom right here. What does I stand for? That's like back from the first test. That's iodine, right? So in order for thyroxine to be active, to have efficacy, it has to have iodine bound at these locations. And it can either have four, in which case we would call that tetraiodothreonine, or maybe it will lose one, and it's going to then be called triiodothreonine, but we never really talk about it that way. We just say T3 and T4. All right, so T4 would be tetraiodothreonine, that's thyroxine. The active form is actually T3 inside the cells. Okay, but the thyroid gland has to produce this signaling molecule. So what does the thyroid gland have to have in order to make an active form of T4? Even if the thyroid gland is told to make a lot of T4, it's got to have something in order to make it. It's got to have iodine. And guess what? Iodine is an element. You can't make it in your body. You have to have it, and it can't really be stored in your body. You have to have a dietary source for it. Okay? And people that don't have iodine in their diet then won't have these hormones, and there are pathologies associated with not having enough iodine in your diet as a result. Okay. Well, let's consider some common aspects of neural and endocrine regulation. All right, so both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals or signaling molecules to communicate with each other. So in the nervous system, typically what do we call that signaling molecule? Neurotransmitter. And give me a good example of a neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is one, right? Norepinephrine, right? And it works through a synapse. What kind of synapse? A chemical synapse, right? A chemical synapse. All right, the difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is the mode of transport, okay? And in the diversity of effects that hormones can have. So neurotransmitters basically work by producing EPSPs and IPSPs, by what? Regulating ion channels. Hormones can have many other effects inside the cell, and we're going to talk about what some of those effects are. Right? And don't forget, some chemicals can be used as hormones and neurotransmitters, depending on the organ that secretes them. So who can tell me of a chemical that can be considered a hormone in certain circumstances, but a neurotransmitter in other circumstances? like norepinephrine, secreted by an axon terminal used as a neurotransmitter, and norepinephrine released by the adrenal medulla, which then goes into the circulatory system. Okay, I think I have a picture of that in this chapter. Okay, so targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones can only operate if they have what? Specific receptor proteins. Right? So these signaling molecules have to bind to a receptor someplace on the surface of the cell or inside the cell. And of course, in order for your body to have control over that system, these signaling compounds have to be degraded. Once a signal is released into your body, you don't want it to last your whole lifetime, right? So if you tell a muscle to contract by releasing acetylcholine on it, you don't want that skeletal muscle to contract for the rest of your life, because then what would happen? Well, you'd be frozen. You couldn't move, right? So the actions of hormones and neurotransmitters should go away. And if you want that neurotransmitter to reactivate a particular tissue, then it needs to be resecreted. Okay. All right, usually a tissue can respond to a number of different hormones. And if a tissue has two different receptors for two different hormones and it produces the same effect or they work together, then we say that is a synergistic action, right? And guess what we call it when two hormones have an opposite effect on each other? That's antagonistic, which we see down here on the bottom. Okay, but there's some other things that can happen as well. Okay, sometimes two hormones are necessary to produce an effect on the body, right? So sometimes a hormone has what we call a permissive effect if the presence of the first hormone allows the cell to respond in any way to the second hormone. So that's a permissive effect. So you might see that some receptors actually have two binding sites on it. One for one kind of signaling molecule and a second active site for a second signaling molecule. Right? And so that's what we would call the permissive effect. So if the first hormone is missing, then the second hormone can have no action whatsoever because the first hormone is missing. All right, and just like what we learned in terms of enzymes, right, and even receptors, target cells with receptors show specificity, right, which means what? What does specificity kind of mean in everyday language? That the signaling molecule has to have just the right shape to bind to the receptor. And if the shape changes a little bit, then the affinity changes quite drastically, right? So it's very specific for the shape. And if the shape is correct, then you need very low levels of hormone because it fits so perfectly in the active site that it binds to the receptor, right? And there's low capacity for a hormone. That means that there are not very many receptors in your body because it is such high affinity, you don't need to have a lot of receptors. Very few number of receptors will work. Right? And as we mentioned before, the lipophilic hormones have receptor in the target cytoplasm or maybe inside the nucleus because a lipophilic or a hydrophobic molecule can go through the plasma membrane. Right? And because of that, most lipophilic hormones will affect transcription. Now, what the heck is transcription? Transcription is a part of? It's hard to go back a couple months. It's the part of protein synthesis. So which part? First part or second part? That's the first part. That's converting DNA into RNA. So hormones can actually start transcription or the production of proteins. Right, and we call that the genomic action. And the genomic action takes a little while to develop. It could take maybe a half hour or hours before metabolism inside the cell changes. All right. However, receptors for water-soluble hormones have a receptor on the surface of the target cell. And that means then that a hormone can't directly enter the cell. So what do we call that from going from a signal outside the cell to a signal inside the cell? We just call that signal transduction. So in this particular case, the hormone is what we call the first messenger. What becomes activated inside the cell when the receptor binds the first messenger? It produces a second messenger inside the cell. So we're going to look at, and you're familiar with some second messengers already, but we're going to revisit that topic. All right, and so when that happens, we call that the non-genomic action. That's going to change the metabolism of the cell directly, but probably not protein synthesis. It's probably not a transcription factor. All right, so let's look at some hydrophobic kinds of signaling molecules or lipid hormones. All right, so would a lipid like to dissolve in blood? Not necessarily, because blood is water. It's a watery environment. Lipids don't like to dissolve in water. So in most cases, there are protein carrier molecules that can bind the hydrophobic hormone, and as a result, it can then act to dissolve that hormone in plasma. All right, so when a hormone that doesn't like to dissolve in water binds to this carrier protein, then it can dissolve in plasma and can be carried by the plasma. All right, and this is just going to be governed by an equilibrium between the amount of hormone bound to the carriers and some hormone that's free in the plasma. Right? Most is going to be bound to the carrier protein, but it's not going to be glued to it forever. Some is going to dissociate, and when it does, it can, of course, go across the cell membrane, and it will bind to a receptor. So here is a cytoplasmic receptor right here. Sometimes we call this a nuclear hormone receptor. And so now it's bound to it, and then this receptor bound to the hormone goes into the nucleus. We call that translocation. And this nuclear hormone receptor then binds to the DNA. So this nuclear hormone receptor has two domains. It has one domain that can bind, it has affinity for the hormone, and it has another domain that can bind to a segment of DNA. It's got both of these domains. And it can only and the domain that binds to DNA will bind to DNA only when what's happening? When you have a hormone bound to the domain that has the binding site for the hormone. So this bare nuclear hormone receptor won't bind to DNA unless it is also bound to the hormone. Okay. And when it binds to DNA, then that starts transcription. So then we get messenger RNA, and then that ends in producing proteins. Right? And that's going to produce a response in the cell depending on what that particular protein is doing, right? So we call that the steroid hormone response as a result of transcription. So this is kind of a lengthy process. It just doesn't happen, right, in seconds. It takes minutes for this process to happen. Okay, so nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors, right, which activate transcription. And all the steroids are in that family, and thyroid hormone is in that family of action as well, right? So we'll take a look at some of these in some upcoming examples. All right, so a little bit more detail about nuclear hormone receptors. All right, so here is a nuclear hormone receptor. It's got the ligand binding domain because the hormone is a ligand. It's going to bind to this domain. Here's the DNA binding domain. All right, so this is what we call the receptor protein for a particular, like a lipid or a hormone, you know, like a steroid. Okay. All right, so then when the hormone binds, it enters the nucleus. There are sites on DNA. So this is what we call a hormone response element. And you can see that it's broken down into two different components right here. And it's going to bind two different nuclear hormone receptors. So in this particular case, transcription can be affected if we have two nuclear hormone receptors, both activated by binding their hormone, right? So then it binds the DNA. This is what we call dimerization. So you need actually two hormone response elements, right, to actually affect transcription. And sometimes, right, these hormones have to be identical, and we would call that a homodimer or homodimerization, right, if these hormones are going to be the same. In other cases, the hormones have to be different, and we would call that heterodimerization as a result. Okay. Do I have an example? I think I have an example right here. Ah, okay. So here we have the mechanism of thyroid hormone. So here we have triiodothreonine binding to this hormone receptor. We have to also have to have cisretinoic acid bind to a different hormone receptor. So these are two different receptors binding to the hormone response element here before transcription can take place. So this is a dimerization, but would this be a homodimerization or a heterodimerization? A hetero, because it requires two different signaling molecules. So this just shows that retinoic acid has, what, a permissive effect for the action of T3. So T3 won't have an action unless there is retinoic acid present as well. All right, water-soluble hormones don't work through cytoplasmic receptors, but they have cell surface receptors because, of course, they can't enter the cell. And so their actions are mediated by second messengers. The hormone is in the extracellular fluid, so that's the extracellular signal. What do we call the extracellular signal? First messenger, right? And then that controls the development of the second messenger inside the cell. So here is, this might be an exam figure. All right, so here we have a receptor, and it's not an ion channel. What kind of receptor does this look like right here? Yeah, it looks like a G-protein coupled receptor. So here is a hormone, or what could we call this hormone right here? That's a first messenger. That's going to cause the activation of the G-protein. So here we see this alpha subunit dissociate, and it can wander around inside the membrane, and it can bump into another protein that's in the membrane, and this particular protein is adenylate cyclase. And I think we've talked about adenylate cyclase already. It has a part of it that pokes down into the cytoplasm, and it can bind ATP. It can chop off the two terminal phosphates. So we're left with a phosphate-phosphate group. We call that pyrophosphate. And furthermore, what's left over is cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP is AMP that has bent back on itself to form a ring structure. And that's a very important signaling molecule, and it's so important that we call it the second messenger inside the cell, right? So the hormone is the first messenger that activates adenylate cyclase, which produces a second messenger, namely cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is going to diffuse around inside the cell, and it's going to bind to a protein kinase enzyme. And in this particular case, this protein kinase is inactive, but you should know what does a protein kinase enzyme do? It phosphorylates something, right? So it's going to phosphorylate something. And so it becomes active, and it will phosphorylate a number of different proteins or enzymes inside the cell. And when a big phosphate group gets bound to an enzyme, what is that going to do to the enzyme? A phosphate group, you know, is a PO4 group. It's a pretty big group. It's going to change the conformation or the shape of that enzyme. It could change the shape of the active site, thereby activating that particular enzyme by switching an enzyme on. Right? So protein kinase can either activate or inactivate various enzymes inside the cell. All right, so we're going to have to leave it at that, and I'll show you in the next couple of slides where that's important for some metabolism that we're concerned about all the time. All right, and then that cyclic AMP, once it's bound to this inhibitory subunit, then eventually this will dissociate, and this inhibitory subunit can come back and inactivate the protein kinase. Right, so this hormone can change the action of enzymes inside the cytoplasm, right, due to this adenylate cyclase mechanism. All right, here is the same slide. Now, how does cyclic AMP, how does the level of cyclic AMP go back to normal? How is cyclic AMP deactivated? It's the exact same way how cyclic GMP is inactivated in a rod cell. There is an enzyme that deactivates cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP, and that's what we call phosphodiesterase. Right, so phosphodiesterase is always going to be active, and that's going to get rid of the second messenger inside the cell until you have another hormone binding to this receptor, which then activates adenylate cyclase again. But remember, cyclic AMP can't stay around inside the cell forever, right? It has to be degraded. That's one of the criteria. All right, another second messenger system is due to phospholipase C. All right, so this is another important second messenger system where we have a hormone binding to a G protein coupled receptor that activates a G protein, and the beta gamma unit can then dissolve around inside the plasma membrane, bumping into phospholipase C. Now, what can you tell me about phospholipase? Phospholipase. When you see that term, what does it conjure up? Is it structure, or is it sugar? It's an enzyme. All right, what does an enzyme do? Yeah, it just speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, right? And in particular, from this name of the enzyme, you know it's an enzyme because there's an ASE right here, and this was probably the third phospholipase that was discovered, so instead of calling it phospholipase the third, somebody just said, well, phospholipase C, right? Okay, what's the substrate for phospholipase? That's something else you can tell from the name. Phospholipids. All right. Now, why on earth is there phospholipase C in this membrane? How on earth is phospholipase C ever going to find any substrates to convert into something? Because phospholipase C has to have phospholipid as a substrate in order to convert it into something. How on earth are you ever going to find a phospholipid in the plasma membrane? Well, what can you tell me about the basic nature of any membrane? The basic building block is a phospholipid, right? So the basic structure of the cell membrane, or any kind of membrane, is a phospholipid that acts as a substrate for controlling metabolism inside the cell. All right, so phospholipase actually dissolves or uses the membrane as a substrate to produce inositol 3-phosphate. I just call that IPI3. All right, and so IPI3 then dissolves out of the membrane, floats around inside the cytoplasm, and it bumps into endoplasmic reticulum, and it causes the release of calcium from endoplasmic reticulum. And so calcium in this particular case is acting as a second messenger inside the cell due to binding of this hydrophilic hormone outside the cell. All right, so I think you might be a little fascinated that even something, the relationship between structure and function of the cell membrane, right? The structure of the cell membrane is a phospholipid, and that's necessary in order to transduce a hormone signal to the inside of the cell producing the second messenger. All right, and we're going to see what this calcium signal can do a little bit later on. Okay, so phospholipase C uses the membrane as a substrate to make inositol 3-phosphate, another signaling molecule that actually stays inside the membrane called diacylglycerol. And in both cases, that's going to increase calcium inside the cell, and that's going to be used as a second messenger. Okay, so calcium then diffuses into the cytoplasm, and it binds and activates calmodulin. I think we've talked about calmodulin before. Calmodulin has an active site for calcium. All right, and then the calmodulin calcium complex can activate protein kinases, which do what? They phosphorylate various enzymes inside the cell, either activating them or inactivating them, changing the metabolism inside the cell, producing the effects of what the intent of that action of the hormone is. All right, so let's look at a specific example. Okay. Epinephrine usually is, we consider that a hormone or a neurohormone that comes from the adrenal gland. And epinephrine can act via two different second messenger systems. What were the two that we learned about? Cyclic AMP and calcium, right? Okay. So here we have a liver cell. And what can you tell me about a liver cell? What can it do for us? A liver cell stores something. Glycogen, right? Okay, it stores glycogen. And what's the basic building block of glycogen? It's glucose, right? So the liver is real important for maintaining the proper level of glucose in our blood. Because when blood glucose decreases, the liver can chop off glucose from glycogen, put it in the blood. That maintains the homeostasis of blood glucose, right? All right, so here we have epinephrine, right? And it is not a lipid. It's a water-soluble hormone, so it can't get inside the cell, which means what? It has to bind to a receptor on the outside of the cell. So there's a receptor here and a receptor right here, right? There's a beta-adrenergic effect on epinephrine. So maybe you learned already that beta-adrenergic receptors work through cyclic AMP, alpha-adrenergic receptors work through calcium as second messengers. Because when we looked at the autonomic nervous system, what was that? Chapter 9, I believe. Okay. So beta-adrenergic receptors, right? When it binds that G-protein coupled receptor, that activates, I think it was the alpha subunit, it bumps into adenylate cyclase on the surface of the, or inside the plasma membrane. Adenylate cyclase takes ATP, converts it into cyclic AMP, and that activates a protein kinase. And so protein kinase does what? It chops down glycogen, and it produces a glucose, but not just any kind of glucose, what? A glucose 1-phosphate. So hence that we call that a protein kinase, because it's phosphorylating that glucose. All right, so that produces glucose 1-phosphate. And then because there's a little isomerization step that can be converted into glucose 6-phosphate. And then what kind of enzyme converts glucose 6-phosphate into just free old glucose? Yeah, glucose 6-phosphatase, right? And then that glucose is free to go into the blood, and that raises blood glucose levels, right? All right, the other one is the alpha-adrenergic effect of epinephrine results. This is utilizing inositol 3-phosphate that increases calcium levels inside the liver cell that then binds to calmodulin that activates other protein kinases, which then also break down glycogen into glucose. And what does that do to glucose in the blood? That increases blood glucose levels. All right, so here is an important mechanism for controlling blood glucose levels using adenylate cyclase as a second messenger and calcium as a second messenger using different receptors on the plasma membrane of a liver cell. Okay. All right, so glucose. What good is glucose? What is glucose good for in your body? Energy. How so? Because it enters a Krebs cycle, right, and then that fuels, no, it enters glycolysis, sorry, right, and then pyruvate, good thing you took the test, not me last time, right, glucose enters glycolysis, produces pyruvate, and pyruvate can enter Krebs cycle after it's decarboxylated, right, and then all those things go through electron transport chain, producing a lot of ATP. All right, so glucose is very important, but glucose can't get into a cell by itself because it is hydrophilic, right? If you take glucose and put it in water, what's going to happen to it? Completely dissolve, right? So it can't get through the plasma membrane. So it needs a passport to get through the plasma membrane, and that passport signal is a hormone that we call insulin. Insulin has to be available for most tissues to take up glucose. Otherwise, glucose can't get inside the cell. What happens to cells if there's no insulin around? Well, they starve to death. All right, that's what happens during when somebody has diabetes mellitus, right? It kills their whole body. But in particular, the tissues that require a lot of glucose, like your brain and your retina and your kidneys, right, are highly susceptible, die very early on when somebody has uncontrolled diabetes. All right, so let's look at how insulin works. Okay, there are two proteins in the cell membrane, and here you can see the active site. They just float around inside the membrane. Insulin can't get inside the cell because it's a protein, it's hydrophilic. And when there is an insulin signal, it activates a tyrosine kinase receptor. So this is a tyrosine kinase receptor. When insulin is present, it completes the active site. It causes dimerization of the tyrosine kinase. All right, so the part that's sticking down into the cytoplasm, all right, can now phosphorylate the tyrosine kinase. And so the receptor becomes phosphorylated. Two ATPs are used. So now the tyrosine kinase is activated. So what the heck does tyrosine kinase do? What does a kinase do? It phosphorylates, and in this particular case, it's going to phosphorylate tyrosine residues on a number of different proteins inside the cell. So here is a protein, and it can come by the insulin receptor, and it's going to phosphorylate this protein right here. And so now what can happen to this protein when it's phosphorylated? It's like poking you in the side. Changes conformation. It's going to change the activity of this particular enzyme, which is going to produce a cascade of effects, which then promotes glucose uptake and all the anabolic reactions when glucose enters the cell. All right, so I need another slide to talk about how that works. Okay, so we said glucose can't get across the cell membrane. It needs a carrier molecule for facilitated diffusion. What can you tell me about facilitated diffusion? How does diffusion go? From high concentration to low concentration. So the energy in the gradient is going to drive glucose in the cell, but glucose can't get in the cell because it can't get through the plasma membrane. But as soon as we put this transporter in the membrane, glucose can go from high concentration to low concentration inside the cell. All right, and so here is a GLUT4 transporter. And the GLUT4 transporter won't be in the plasma membrane. It's going to be in this endosome right here. Unless there is insulin present on the outside of the cell. If there's an insulin signal, then this tyrosine kinase becomes active. It's going to phosphorylate a number of other enzymes inside the cell that have tyrosine. And when that happens, this endosome is going to translocate over to the plasma membrane, bringing along these GLUT4 transporters. So now where do you have the GLUT4 transporters? They used to be in this endosome inside the cell, but now you have them in the plasma membrane of the cell, and then they can translocate glucose to the inside of the cell. But this only happens when there is an insulin signal. Right? The other processes inside the cell always are recovering parts of the plasma membrane and sticking them into endosomes. So when the insulin signal goes away, what happens to these GLUT4 transporters? They sort of lose activity. They're still active, but because they're in an endosome inside the cell, they can't allow for cellular uptake of glucose because they're trapped in this endosome. So what's the signal for putting this endosome or these transporters back into the plasma membrane? It's going to be this insulin signal from outside the cell, and this all works by phosphorylating various kinds of enzymes that are inside the cell. And this is very rapid. These endosomes can be placed into the membrane very, very rapidly, right? As opposed to if it was a steroid kind of hormone, how long would it take to build all of these GLUT4 transporters? Okay, it might take days to get the proper level of these GLUT4 transporters inserted into the plasma membrane if you had to build every transporter amino acid by amino acid by amino acid. But since they're built, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of them and stored in this endosome as a reservoir, then it's very easy just to insert them into the plasma membrane because they're all ready and willing to go to work for us. Just waiting for this insulin signal. Yeah. The second messenger, it's going to be these phosphorylated, you know, I can't really say there is a second messenger in here. It's just that these enzymes become activated. So it's not a cyclic AMP. It's not a calcium signal. It's not inositol 3-phosphate. It's just that this enzyme on the tyrosine kinase receptor becomes activated when it binds insulin. So do you see a second messenger on this slide someplace? No? You just heard... Huh? You mentioned it. No, I don't really see a second messenger in this particular system. Okay? But the signal is transduced by the creation of these phosphorylated enzymes inside the cell. So I suppose you could think of those phosphorylated enzymes as being a second messenger, but I've never heard anybody talk about it that way.
Cross that out.
Where do you see that? Where do you see that?
Second messengers cause vesicles containing GLUT4.
Let's just call them signaling molecules, phosphorylated intermediates. Okay, and maybe not second messengers because I can't tell you what the exact name of any of those second messengers are. Okay, but, all right, so this would be like at the forefront of research that's trying to understand, for instance, diabetes mellitus. All right, because some people have diabetes because they don't produce the insulin signal. All right, but other people have diabetes with normal levels of insulin, right, but for a long time, we probably didn't realize what was causing that, but if they have normal levels of insulin, right, but maybe there is a problem with the receptor, right? The tyrosine kinase isn't working, or with this other process right here that's producing these signaling molecules, or something in the control of moving these endosomes over to the plasma membrane and inserting the GLUT4 transporters. So there's probably many different kinds of diabetes depending on exactly what part of the metabolism inside the cell is malfunctioning, right? So being low on insulin is only one possible cause. But this whole process, right, has to work properly in order to get glucose inside the cell. Okay, as an aside, all right, so you need this GLUT4 transporter to take up glucose. And this usually happens when there is an insulin signal. Now, there's something else that happens too, and this is a really good way to understand why we recommend that people with diabetes watch their diet, right, low in sugar, plus do something else. What do we tell everybody to maintain health? Diet and exercise. In a particular case, the exercise that we're interested in is exercising muscle, contracting muscle, right? In muscle cells, right, they will respond to insulin if there is a normal tyrosine kinase receptor, but there's something else that will insert GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane, and that's when you exercise a muscle, right? So when somebody that's a diabetic exercises, they're actually circumventing this insulin signaling component of the GLUT4 transporter system. They're automatically putting GLUT4 transporters into the muscle cells, membranes. And so what are the muscle cells doing? They are lowering blood glucose levels as a result. So exercise really acts like insulin. Right, because it causes the fusion of these endosomes into the cell membrane. So exercise probably is important for all of us for that reason, and that will help protect the pancreas and these insulin receptors for a much longer period of time. All right, so this might be an exam figure. This might be an exam figure. So just kind of recapping, what kind of receptor is the insulin receptor? Insulin receptor, it's not a G protein coupled receptor. It's not a ligand gated ion channel. Where do I have it? Tyrosine kinase receptor. Right? So when this receptor binds insulin, then the part of the receptor that is cytoplasmic can phosphorylate tyrosine residues on various regulatory compounds inside the cell. All right, so you've learned a couple really good kinds of receptors. Ligand-gated ion channels, G protein coupled, tyrosine kinase is another kind of receptor. Yeah, where's that sign-in sheet at? Where's the sign-in sheet? It's coming down. Yeah, keep it moving. That's okay. I started in the back today. That's why. All right, I'll try and get these. Somebody asked me about lectures. Yeah, I haven't put a lecture online in about 2 weeks. So I'll try and get the lectures on as soon as I can. Okay.